Good morning, Portland, Maine. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O and News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM. Shani, how are we doing today?
I'm very good. How are you?
It's May 24th. Beautiful day here in Maine. It feels like it's the first time in about 7 months when the fear of cold weather or winter isn't upon us. Is that fair?
Yeah.
I mean, you still think there could be bad weather?
Yes, I do. Memorial Day weekend, I'm nervous.
Okay, half glass empty. Yeah. Shani, you know, my other fear is we'll wake up a few weeks from now, open up a newspaper, and see ads for snowplows.
Never ending.
It's never ending. Anyhow, we've got a really interesting show this week. In about 10 minutes, we will go to an interview that I recorded earlier this week with Senator George Mitchell, one of my political heroes. His resume is long and really incredible in terms of both being a U.S. senator, Senate Majority Leader, the work he's done as a international work. It's just, and he's one of the few people who was ever asked if he wanted to be appointed to the Supreme Court, and he turned down Bill Clinton in 94. So it'll be exciting to play that interview. Fascinating man. Enjoyed having him. And then in the second hour at 12:06, we have another interview we recorded earlier with Alan Hall, who is an entrepreneur and speaker and writer from Utah. And everyone's familiar about the Forbes list where Maine has been ranked 50th for the last 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, no good.
No good. Utah apparently was ranked number one. So Alan came in and tried to explain exactly how Maine can go from 50th to one. I don't believe it involves widespread conversion to Mormonism.
Oh, no.
No.
That wasn't.
That wasn't even part of the whole thing. It's really about economic enterprise and education and taking down tax barriers. So we'll talk to him about that. And what do we have on this day? We have, birthdays, 1941. Bob Dylan. If your time to you, he was born in 1940. He turned 73. When Dylan came out in the 60s and 70s, again, you weren't born, so you probably have very faint memories. Nobody could ever really understand what he was saying.
Yeah, that remains true.
And I always thought that if I could only learn to play guitar, I could be like, and you never do, and then you say this, and then you wee. But nobody could do that better than Bob Dylan. What a classic. Well, happy birthday, Bob Dylan. Also, Ricky Craven, Maine native Ricky Craven, who had a successful NASCAR career. Now he's an ESPN broadcaster. He turns 48. Patti LaBelle, a disco diva. She turns 70. Wow. What is voulez-vous faucher? Any idea? Do we have a translator?
No.
It sounds like something interesting, though.
I think it's risque.
Really?
I do.
You don't think it's education-based? You don't think it's an environmental message? You think it has to do with, romance, the art of romance?
Yes.
It feels that way. Anyhow, Patti LaBelle, she turns 70 today. Also, Priscilla Presley turns 69. But we have a special guest in the studio.
Yes, we do.
Wow, nice theme music. By the way, please welcome Jenny McDonald. She's in the studio. How you doing, Jenny?
I'm good. Thanks for having me. I like to refer to myself as Jenny from the Woods. Not really Jenny from the Block, but thanks for that intro music, Shannon.
Do we have a song for that, Jenny from the Woods?
I do not have a song for that. That's just kind of my tagline.
Unless there's a song for it, then we cannot recognize Jenny from the Woods. I'm sorry. You have to be Jenny from the Block. We have worked together for a few months now. Jenny is our digital social media, I was going to say guru or goddess or however you'd like to be referred to. You're certainly an expert in the field. And I wanted to spend a couple minutes talking about what's going on here in Maine relative to digital social media. And one of the reasons I wanted to put you on the spot is you are a ferocious tweeter, Facebooker, everything involving social media. And I just looked on Twitter, and you have 2,710 followers. I don't know if I've ever met 2,700 people in my life. So why don't we start there and talk about how you first got interested in social digital media, and then we'll talk a little bit about what's going on here in Maine and a program that we're trying to put together in a few months here at Tidesmart.
Absolutely. So in regards to Twitter, my resume might not be as impressive as George Mitchell's, but my Twitter followers might be.
Mm-hmm. You have an army.
So I did start Twitter back in 2009, so I've had some years to acquire those followers. That's helpful. And moving several times across the country helps you get more followers when you're hopping city to city and going to all these digital networking events in big cities like Seattle and New York City.
Mm-hmm.
And connecting just with a lot when you're at conferences, that helps you get good followers. But as you can find out on my blog, the best way to get the right types of Twitter followers would be to share relevant, great content about yourself and about what you're trying to promote within your community. And now that I'm back in Maine, I do tweet a lot about the amazing life we have here in Maine and the people that make it up. And we do have a lot of cool, exciting digital meetups and seminars that are happening right here in the state. And a lot of people, you know, don't expect that from Maine. And when I was in Seattle, a lot of people asked me if Maine was part of Canada.
That's
so
fun.
You know, it's a surprise.
Explain what a tweet up is, because I've always been intimidated. I'm on Twitter and I always feel like a 15-year-old kid driving on the turnpike for the first time, where other cars are swerving around and passing me, and I'm writing things on Twitter like I had a nice lunch, and other people are writing the most witty, profound things. Talk a little bit about Twitter content, and then when you mentioned tweet-ups, is it something that is more social, where it's a mechanism for people who tweet a lot to get together? Or is there any kind of business application or opportunity with that?
Tweetups shouldn't feel like you're in a sports car that you've never driven before. They're basically a networking event and a chance for people to come together focused around a similar idea of interest. That's why they use tweetups originally, because it's focused around Twitter. But mostly it's usually focused around an industry or an event that's coming up. And you can go and just really meet with people. The great thing about tweetups is that you're there and you're meeting people and you can immediately follow them on Twitter because they're there. So you assume they're on Twitter and you'll see people in the hashtag for the event. What is a hashtag? A hashtag is a pound symbol followed by a specific set of words that you can use to search a topic of interest online.
I like this where you asked the question and you answered it in one string. And as the radio host, that makes my job so easy, where hashtag, what's a hashtag? The hashtag is, it's fantastic. Shani, we're going to have Jenny on the block here more often.
I agree. She's doing great.
We need to have a digital session at least once a month.
Fantastic. So for the tweet-ups, it always feels like maybe it's the cool kids.
Yeah, that is how a lot of people feel. And when we get into talking about the event we have coming up here, don't feel like it's always the cool kids. It's just a networking opportunity for you to meet more people in your community, learn a little bit more about maybe something that you don't know, such as social media, mm-hmm. and get to speak to some of the people who have been using social, like myself, for a very long time, and some of the influencers in your community, which if you're a business owner, that's a great opportunity for you to connect with somebody who's really well known online and build a relationship with them and introduce them to your products and services. And if you know you have a great relationship, they're probably going to promote that for you for free.
Why don't we talk a little bit about the idea that we're working on here in terms of a day here at Tidesmart? And although we're still in the planning stage, maybe you can talk a little bit about what the plan is pointing towards.
Absolutely. So Mashable is a content curation creator platform online. It's called MASHABLE.com. And they're really the big wigs when it comes to social media trends and the industry. They created Social Media Day 5 years ago, and it is a global event. It's held in cities all around the world on June 30th. And what happens is people get together and promote their love for using social media. It's just a way for people to get together and have fun. And so on June 30th, we're hoping to do that here at Tidesmart for the 5th annual Social Media Day. There has been one in Maine before in 2011, but there hasn't been a big push behind it. So we're really reaching out to the community, and we want to invite everybody from Aroostook County all the way down to southern Maine.
Fantastic. And for anyone listening that would like to follow Jenny on Twitter, why don't you give your Twitter name, Twitter feed?
Sure. My Twitter name is @, the @ symbol, JENNI. MacDonald. And you can tweet me 24 hours a day almost. If as long as I'm not sleeping, I'll respond to you.
Really?
People do tweet me, and I love to tweet back. If you have questions, go ahead and send me a tweet.
Well, I am a bit of a neophyte, but my Twitter handle is SteveOWoods, S-T-E-V-O-E-W-O-O-D-S. It's an interesting platform, and I think now in the digital age, there are lots of platforms from Facebook to Instagram to Twitter, and it feels like every few months something else comes up, but it's using the internet and the digital dimension to connect people, which I think in most cases is a good thing.
Every business owner, every CEO should be using social media to talk about their company and show transparency as their brand.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for being with us today during the opening segment. Will you come back sometime, Jen?
Absolutely. Anytime. I'll be here tweeting, taking pictures.
Tweeting, pictures, everything. Fantastic.
Yep.
This will be on Saturday, the 24th. And now we will go into our pre-recorded interview that I had with Senator George Mitchell right now. Welcome back to Time Smart Talk with Steve-O. This is News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM. Please join me in welcoming our very, very special guest, Senator George Mitchell. Senator Mitchell, thank you for being with us this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm not sure if you remember, but a couple of weeks ago, we met during your induction into the Maine Sports Hall of Fame, so congratulations on that.
Thank you. I remember very well both the ceremony and meeting and talking with you.
Wasn't that a great idea? I obviously want to talk about your broader political experience, but wasn't that a great ceremony a couple weeks ago to really tribute to both student athletes and for some of the folks who have really added to our culture here in Maine relative to sport?
It was. The Maine State Hall of Fame is really a terrific institution and is fortunate now to have Dick Whitmore running it. Dick was himself a great athlete at Bowdoin and then coached for about 40 years at Colby College in basketball. And he's a great guy, been a friend of mine and of my family for many, many decades.
Likewise, I've only known him for a few years, but he's one of those iconic figures that it feels like as you travel throughout Maine, he's touched so many people in their lives in terms of both sport and academics and just community involvement, one of our great iconic figures. As we start here, Senator Mitchell, I wanted to talk just real briefly in terms of, I think everyone is familiar with your iconic stature as one of Maine's true patriots relative to your service in a number of different areas. But talk a little bit about the early years being born in Waterville, Maine, and what really led you on the path of public service, because one of the things that we talk about here on Time Smart is how important that is in every area of our society. Policy and government can play really positive roles, but I personally think we need more young people who, instead of just being critical of government, look at government when it's practiced well, can really be an important and critical force in all of our lives. So why don't we talk about you growing up in Waterville and what led you into public service?
I was the fourth of five children, three older brothers and a younger sister. My mother was an immigrant from Lebanon. She couldn't read or write English and worked her entire life in textile mills on the night shift. My father was the orphan son of Irish immigrants. He didn't know his parents, and he was raised in an orphanage, then adopted by an elderly Maine couple in Bangor. They subsequently moved to Waterville, where my father was raised, and when my mother immigrated, she moved to Waterville to live with her sister, who had preceded her as an immigrant. So they met in the 1920s in Waterville, and I was born in 1933 and so raised during the Depression. By current standards, we would be called poor, but nobody ever felt that way. Everybody worked. All of the kids worked. My parents worked very hard. And having no education themselves, the goal in life of my parents was that their children would be able to get an education, and they really were insistent that every child go to college. And in that, they succeeded. All five of us graduated from college. A couple of us have graduate degrees. I really wasn't very much interested in politics. Two things, one humorous, one serious, led me to it. The humorous one was that my three older brothers were very famous athletes. My brother Johnny Mitchell was one of the best basketball players ever to play in Maine. If you listen to him, he was the best, but I think there were others in that same category. And then I came along, and I was not as good as my brothers. In fact, I wasn't as good as anybody else's brother. And so very early in life, I developed both an inferiority complex and a highly competitive attitude toward my brothers. And when I could not achieve their level of success in sports, I thought about other ways that I might be able to get involved publicly. And by just chance, politics came along. That happened later, after I graduated from law school at Georgetown University in Washington. I tried to get a job with a Maine law firm, but couldn't get one. I did receive an offer from the United States Department of Justice, so I went to work there as a trial lawyer. After a couple of years, I still wanted to get back to Maine. I was contacted by the office of Senator Muskie. Senator Muskie didn't know me, but he had married a woman, Jane Gray, from Waterville, and he'd actually moved to Waterville to practice law, so he knew my brothers, knew of the family. And he had a vacancy on his staff and asked me if I'd like to join it. I told him I would, but I said I was very truthful with him. I said, I'm really not much interested in politics, but I do want to get back to Maine and practice law. He said, well, look, if you stay through the next election, which is about 3 years away, that's fine with me, and you can use the time to try to make contacts and get established in the law, which is what happened. But by the time I got back to Maine to practice law, I did in Portland for many years, I'd become interested in politics, primarily through the influence of Senator Muskie himself, who was a great senator and a great man.
Would you mind taking just 1 minute for, you know, I've studied Senator Edmund Muskie for many years, and by the way, we have Senator George Mitchell on the phone. Could you talk a little bit about not just the political side, but Senator Muskie, the man, the person that you had the honor of working with, and for somebody just starting out in his legal career, which later led into a distinguished career in government service, what was it like and what was he like in terms of a figure in your life and development?
He was, after my parents, the most influential person in my life by far. He really was a really great man. First, he was tall, 6'4", very imposing figure, probably the smartest person I've ever met, and brilliant politically. And so most of my political instincts and values derive from my association with him. When I started, Senate staffs were small. The world was very much different than this is in the 1960s. And he asked me to come and join him on his trips around Maine. I used to drive him around Maine and serve sort of as a gopher and a driver and a note taker and a speechwriter and everything in between. And so I traveled from one end of Maine to the other with Senator Muskie. Back then, times were different. We used to stay in these motels in rural Maine, two single beds to a room. So we really were close friends, and I really was influenced by him, and particularly by his approach to public service. He was a man of great integrity. He was not condescending to people. He was human, and he had faults. He had a ferocious temper, and when he chewed you out, it was something you never forgot. And I never forgot the several times I got chewed out. But overall, I think he was an historical figure, probably the greatest environmental legislator in all of American history, the architect of the two bedrocks of environmental protection in the United States, the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act.
And was that driven by his relationship in Maine and by traveling around Maine? And obviously, we have you know, to me, there's some contradictions in Maine. We have one of the most beautiful rural states where not only are we a coastal state, but we have rivers and lakes, and we have topography and mountains. So we have such beautiful land. But because of some of our dependency on oil and because of the way we're kind of spread out across the state, there are times where we're not very environmentally progressive. As example, electric vehicle charging stations. We only have a handful in Maine. But do you think Senator Muskie was really, you know, his interest in environmental law and policy was driven from just living in Maine and seeing the beauty of Maine?
Well, I think it was more immediate than that. He grew up in Rumford, and there was and is a paper mill there, and it was a heavy polluter, both to air pollution, the odor, and to the waters, as were all of the mills really all around the world at that time. There was not the environmental consciousness that there is now. And I grew up in Waterville, right on the banks of the Kennebec River, and directly across the river from the house I lived on was what was then the Hollingsworth Whitney, later the Scott Paper Mill, which had the same problems. Back then, when he began his efforts in the Senate to write the Clean Water Act, 85% of all of the waterways in the United States, and the figure was probably higher in Maine, were polluted, unusable for most purposes, drinking water, fishing, swimming, boating, anything. After the Clean Air Act was passed, over a period of about a quarter century leading up to today, the figures are reversed. About 15% of American waterways are polluted and 85% are clean. You can now use the Kennebec River, the Androscoggin, the Penobscot, the Saco in ways that were not usable when I was a kid growing up and when Senator Muskie was growing up. I mean, they really were stinking open sewers. So he was directly influenced, I believe, by the environment in which he grew up and a desire to improve it. And, of course, that's true in many areas of life, how we've become aware of the consequences of actions that previously there was not an aware of. I mentioned my mother worked in textile mills. I've been in many, many textile mills. Back then, it was very difficult. Heavy lint exposure in the factories. My mother would come home in the morning at 7 o'clock from work. Her hair, she'd have lint all over her clothes, in her ears. I mean, it was really very difficult. They've now greatly improved that in textile production. So you had a lot of things in life that were different then, much worse, actually, and that have been improved through an awareness, and Senator Muskie was instrumental in focusing that awareness and enacting national laws which have done much to clean up American waters and American air.
We're honored to have Senator George Mitchell with us today, obviously long-term serving in the U.S. Senate, also Senate Majority Leader from 1989 to 1995. So after your experience with Senator Muskie, did he encourage you to continue your commitment in terms of both public policy and public service, and what were the next steps in your progression?
After he was reelected in 1964, my commitment to him ended, and I came back to Maine. I found a job with a law firm in Portland, a terrific group of men. It was called Jensen and Baird, Ray Jensen, Ken Baird, Mert Henry, who is still living in Portland, was a great, great mentor of mine. And I did become involved in politics. I became the chairman of the Maine Democratic Party, then a Democratic National Committee man, because my interest had been sparked by my experience with Senator Muskie. But I thoroughly enjoyed the years that I lived in Portland and practiced law. Then after President Carter was elected, Senator Muskie appointed an independent panel to review applicants for the position of United States Attorney for Maine. That's the chief federal prosecutor. I applied, was one of several names recommended by the panel. Senator Muskie chose me, and the president appointed me U.S. Attorney, where I served for about 3.5 years with offices in Portland and Bangor. Then a new judgeship was created in Maine. Prior to that, there'd only been one federal judge. The law was changed to provide for two, and following a similar procedure, I was appointed as a federal judge in Maine and worked in both Bangor and Portland for less than a year until the vacancy occurred in the Senate when Senator Muskie was appointed Secretary of State. And Governor Joe Brennan then appointed me to complete Senator Muskie's term about a couple of years in the Senate. Then I was elected a couple of times after that.
Well, I think you're also being modest. We have Senator George Mitchell. You were elected in 1982. You served for 15 years. But then in 1988, when you ran for re-election, I believe you received about 81% of the vote, the largest margin in the history of the state of Maine. So that takes, you know, you obviously the legislation you were involved in terms of, you know, NAFTA, in terms of the Americans with Disabilities Act. Talk about a little bit the climate of, you know, everyone now, you know, both in statewide politics and people looking at the national landscape, talk about the divisiveness and kind of this contentiousness. You have, I think, a longer lens than most because of your experience and because of your success and the respect that you earned as, you know, not just as a Democrat, not just having to do with your party, but having to do with your real leadership. Talk about your time in the U.S. Senate and the working relationship that you experienced with people from both sides of the aisle, and then compare that a little bit to today's environment, if you wouldn't mind.
On the day that I was elected Majority Leader of the U.S. Senate, I called Bob Dole, who was the Republican, or then the Minority Leader in the Senate, and I went to see him. And I said to him, look, these are very difficult jobs, and they're darn near impossible if we don't have a trusting relationship between us. So I said, I'm here to tell you how I intend to behave toward you, and to ask you, please, to behave in the same way toward me. And I set out pretty basic standards of fairness and conduct. I told him that I would never try to embarrass him, that I would not ever criticize him personally, that while we would disagree often on issues, we should keep it on the issues. I told him that I would never surprise him, which is an important factor in the Senate, given its rules. He was delighted. When I finished, we shook hands, and to this moment, never once has a harsh word ever passed between Bob Dole and me, in public or in private. We disagreed almost every day. We negotiated every day, a lot of issues, but our friendship and our trust in each other was rock solid. So it can be done. The personal attacks that now are so much a part of our politics are not essential to advancing the public interest. And we cooperated on a lot of legislation. We disagreed on a lot. Sometimes his view prevailed, sometimes mine prevailed, but it never led us to descend into the kind of personal attacks that occur now. Now, I do believe politics is rougher now than it has been, certainly in recent history and in my lifetime. But I think you have to put it in some context. Politics has always been rough in the United States. About a year ago, Steve, a professor at the University of Maine named Amy Freed published an article in the Bangor Daily News describing the presidential election of 1800, in which two great icons of American history, Thomas Jefferson was the challenger, and John Adams was the incumbent. And the things that their supporters said about the other were much harsher than what's said in modern times. The difference, of course, is that there was no television, and there was no electronic media. What was said appeared in print and often read by only a few people, distant in time and location from where it was first spoken or written. Now it's overwhelming.
Well, what other reasons, by the way, Senator? We have Senator George Mitchell on the phone. You know, when you served from 1980 to 1995, other than the media and the internet and the vacuum that is, you know, all this communications needing content, are there any other variables that you would ascribe to the success you had collaborating in the Senate versus now. And my feeling is that it is much worse over the last 20 years. But more than that, it's trickled down from the national level to Augusta. And now I think what we're seeing in local municipalities, I'm chairman of the Yarmouth Town Council, and we're fortunate in the town of Yarmouth that I think we have a very productive and very constructive government relationship between the citizens and the council. But you see local municipalities, people being recalled, people, lawsuits and public, it's starting to trickle down to neighborhood politics. What would you prescribe that to from your experience between 20 years ago and now?
It's not so much the sense that an individual House member or senator takes a bribe. Nobody comes in and says, here's $100,000 or $10,000. Will you vote on this bill this way? It's more subtle than that, but it's still corrupting. And the true corruption is that the bond of trust between the people and their representatives, their elected officials, has been severed. People don't trust politicians anymore at any level, and most certainly at the congressional, national level. I travel around the country, Steve, and I ask audiences all the time, this is college audiences, business audiences, various groups, all around the country, I ask this question. Does anyone here believe that your representative in Congress is more responsive to his or her constituents than to his or her donors?
Right.
And in all that time, only one person has raised her hand. It was in Washington, D.C. a few months ago, and a woman raised her hand. And I said to her, I said, you're the only person that's ever raised your hand, so I don't want to embarrass you, but do you mind standing up and explaining to us why you believe as you do? She got up and she said, it's very simple. My husband's a member of Congress.
That's a funny story. Let me ask you something, and I don't want to put you on the spot, yeah, but at the same time, I greatly respect your service and your perspective. To what degree do you believe this phenomena that you just described, whether it's the phenomena that was that led to the Citizen United decision and money, how much of that do we in our democracy, should we place some accountability in the electorate? And by that question, let's just look at Maine as an example. We have about 1.3 million people, approximately 917,000 registered voters. I believe, my personal hypothesis is that over the last 40 or 50 years, there's been a decay in our democracy, a decay in real participation, not just voting rates, but understanding issues and policies. And to a great extent, we the voters, we the citizens, we own this democracy, and the people we elect on the local, state, county, federal level, they're serving us. And if the citizens, the voters, are taking less and less time to be informed and understanding the issues, and on the extreme side of the spectrum, you know, in Minnesota, you know, 10, 15 years ago, they elected a wrestler, Jesse Ventura, and we see from both parties people being elected that aren't necessarily serious in their qualification or their dedication to service. How much of the phenomena can we put at the feet of voters? Yeah, I know it's not a popular political position, but do we get the government we deserve, and is there anything we can do to get people more engaged and educated, because that may be the start of the change?
Well, I think it goes beyond American voters. The reality is, of course, that as human beings, we constantly receive and process information which we use to make decisions. And it is true of humans everywhere, not just people living in America today, that we tend to have wide open receptors in our brain for information that is consistent with our prior beliefs, something that validates what we already believe. And we have very small or closed receptors to contrary information. That's true across the spectrum, whatever one's political beliefs. And it's very hard to penetrate with a contrary argument and facts to people whose minds are so firmly fixed in one direction. One of the big changes in American life has been that whatever your point of view, you can now get constant validations for it. If you watch television, there's one cable network that's one way, another cable network the other way. Newspapers and other forms of information tend to be one way or the other. In addition, and this is a crucial factor, is the technology is neutral. It provides tremendous benefits to us in so many aspects of our lives, but it also produces negative results. And one is that with the opening of the internet and most people now wired in, the amount of information has increased exponentially, and with it, the amount of misinformation. Every day on my cell phone, which I get emails, I get hundreds of emails with points of view literally all over the world. Most of them I don't sign up for. People just happen to get my address and send it to me. And I have no way of knowing what is true and what isn't true. Indeed, in the few matters that I actually know something about, much of the information is untrue. So we're flooded with information. And because we're flooded with it, we tend to gravitate toward those sources of information which we trust and rely on because they agree with our point of view. So you do have an increasing polarization, and frankly, I think it's getting worse. Secondly, people always have had the ability to rationalize that the national interest is one consistent with their self-interest. In fact, that's one of the toughest jobs, Steve, in elective office. How do you distinguish the broader interests of society from those of your constituents? And most people who are elected don't distinguish. What they do is they convince themselves that what's good for my constituents is good for the whole body, either the county, the state, the city, or the nation. That's the toughest task of leadership. Having enough independent judgment and a sense of conscience and right and wrong that you can make those distinctions and you can act upon them. And people do hold and advocate contrary opinions all the time. People in public office know that. I used to get dozens and dozens, hundreds really, of people who'd come in and see me, and the first thing they'd say is, you got to balance the budget. And then the next thing they'd say is they wanted me to favor some bill that helped their industry or their cause or something that would unbalance the budget. In other words, the views advocated were almost always directly contradictory, but they were able to rationalize that it was someone else's spending that contributed to the problem, not the spending that favored them. And that those are huge challenges for political leaders in extremely contentious and difficult times.
I mean, I couldn't agree more. We have Senator George Mitchell on the phone. But I think there's also been, I don't know if it's a deterioration or an evolution, where people have gone from entertaining their own subjective opinions to trying to present those as facts. You know, if 30 or 40% of people really believe that President Obama was born in Kenya, wherein all the evidence and all the live birth certificates and Honolulu news and affidavits from doctors say otherwise, or climate change, which I think is one of the most critical issues today, because it's really the life of the planet and the quality of life of all of us inhabitants. But if people are able to say, well, my opinion is climate change isn't real, and the scientific community, by preponderance of evidence, 99% of scientists believe, hey, this is really serious, I think we lose something when we almost entertain people's opinion and allow that to be introduced as some sort of balancing fact.
Well, I think there is both the attitude that I earlier described and a certain amount of cynicism. It's one thing if an ordinary citizen who's got a couple of kids and trying to get do a good job at work and raise the kids and don't have time to get into the scientific literature material, they often take their cues from political leaders that they trust. And one of the problems we have is that there are some political leaders who, in my judgment, misuse that trust by taking these positions when they really know better.
Right.
If you're a member of the Congressional Environment Committee, part of your job is to inform yourself on issues that come before your committee. You have world-class scientists who come. You have documents prepared for you by members of your staff. I don't expect a person working in any town in Maine who's got a full-time job, a mortgage, and kids, a lot of issues going, to be able to meet with these scientists, to be able to study this stuff. But they look up to the people whose responsibility is, and the leaders who should know better, and I believe in most cases do know better. Nonetheless, cynically, I believe, take positions that they know are not so. That the notion that the whole issue of climate change is a huge international hoax, that there's nothing to it. It's a conspiracy of scientists to somehow cause damage to the American economy. It's demonstrably false. It's plainly false. And yet you have national figures who take that position and say that because they believe that will advance their interest politically. So I accept the premise that you said, that we're all in this together, and we all bear some responsibility, but I think that it is not equal responsibility, and I think the responsibility lies heaviest on those at the leadership level who know better, who ought to be doing their best to educate and inform the public. Well, of course there is some degree of scientific difference. There always has been. There probably are some people somewhere who still believe that the Earth is flat. There may be even people somewhere who believe that the sun rotates around the Earth. Those were common beliefs a long time ago. Science has disproved them, as it has many other things. The responsibility is greater upon leaders who have that awareness, who, for cynical and political reasons, convey a different and an erroneous point of view.
I agree. You're listening to Tad Smart Talk with Steve on News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM. Senator George Mitchell, in our last couple of minutes, I wanted to ask you a couple of quick questions while we have you on the phone. One, at the end, I think it was Bill Clinton had at one point in 1994, wanted to appoint you to the United States Supreme Court, obviously one of the highest honors in the land, and with your legal background. Can you just talk briefly in terms of both that decision and now 20 years later, you know, especially, I don't want to put Citizen United at your foot, because I'm sure if you were on the Supreme Court, you would have advocated vigorously against it. But not many people are invited or appointed to the Supreme Court that turn that down. And if you could give some insight into your thinking back then. And then I also want to talk to you about your current work at the Mitchell Institute. And by the way, the website is www.mitchellinstitute.org. But if you could talk about those two things, I'd appreciate it.
Yes, I'll try to be brief. I decided early in my Senate career that I did not want to make it a lifetime position. I didn't know when or how, but I sort of wanted to leave while people thought I should stay rather than wait until they wanted me to go. So when the time came, it was in 1994, I announced my decision in early March, and the night before, I had dinner with President Clinton. Very long discussion, 2.5 hours. He tried to talk me into staying. I wouldn't do it. And he said to me, well, are you just sour on public life? And I said, no, I love it, I said, but I just want to, I feel I've done my service and done my time. I want to try other things. So about a month later, unexpectedly, a vacancy occurred on the Supreme Court. And the president called me up and said, I want to appoint you to the Supreme Court. I said, well, let me think about it a little bit. At that time, we were embroiled in a huge debate over reforming the American healthcare system. And I had been working closely with a Republican senator, John Chafee of Rhode Island, the father of the current governor of Rhode Island. And John Chafee was a really great man and a fine person, someone who I worked very closely with on environmental issues, a strong environmentalist, a Republican. Not many of them left who are strong environmentalists, but Chafee was. And we thought at the time that there was at least a possibility that we could bridge the gap between the two parties' positions on health care in the Senate. And I said to the president, look, I'm flattered, I'm honored. As a lawyer, being on the Supreme Court is probably the pinnacle of ambition. But I said, I'm the lead sponsor of the health care bill. I'm working with John Chafee. I think we got a shot at getting a comprehensive bill. So there are all kinds of people who could serve on the Supreme Court as well or better than I. And so I turned it down. And as it turned out, we couldn't close the gap, and we didn't pass a bill. So people say, well, don't you regret it? The fact is you make the best decision you can on the circumstances which exist at the time. I did the right thing. I tried to help pass health care. It didn't work. We ended up getting a good Supreme Court justice instead, Stephen Breyer, and I've gone on to do other things. One of the other things I've done is to establish a scholarship fund in Maine for needy Maine students to help them get to college. While I was in the Senate, I spoke at a graduation at every high school in Maine, every single one. And I met thousands of youngsters who I talked with and got to know them, understand their problems. And I saw in many of their eyes a mirror image of myself at their age. I was 16 years old when I graduated from college. I didn't know whether I'd be able to go. My brothers had gone to college on athletic scholarships. My father had lost his job the previous year. He was out of work for a long time. Times were tough. And I had a lot of people help me out who had no motive other than to help this kid out because they maybe saw some promise that I didn't even know existed. And so as I travel around the state going to these high school graduations, I got to do something about this in my life. And when I left the Senate, I created a scholarship fund for needy Maine students. And now we give out one scholarship each year to a graduate from every high school in Maine. There are now about 130 public high schools in Maine, and we give one out every year. Since we started, we've distributed scholarships to about 2,300 Maine students, total of between $11 and $12 million in direct financial assistance to them. And this really, to me now, is my life's work. I devote as much time, effort, and money as I can to helping Maine kids get a college education because I believe it's so essential and because I know that it's the lack of finances that is the largest barrier to youngsters from Maine going on to get a college education. And we emphasize Maine. Most of them go to school in Maine. We set up a network for them in Maine. We do leadership training. We do mentorship. We try to get them interns. We try to help them find jobs. And so far, it's been very successful. Wonderful, wonderful young people. And my goal in life, Steve, which I know I will never be able to attain in a purely mathematical sense, but which I know if I try to do it, I'll do a lot of good along the way. My goal in life is that not one child in Maine will be denied the opportunity to go to college because they didn't have enough money. If they have the talent, the ambition, the drive, the willingness to work, we got to help them get that education to fulfill their God-given talents, not just for their own well-being, but for the well-being of our society and our state.
That's incredible. And is there information at the MitchellInstitute.org website on the program and how people listening can, if they want to either contribute or participate in some way and spread the message?
Yeah. You had the website before. It's located in Portland. It's just the Mitchell's Institute. It has it's a scholarship fund. It's information at every high school in Maine. You can go to your local school and get information. We get a lot of applications. 10% of all high school graduates in Maine apply to us for scholarship assistance. 10%, that's one out of every 10 graduates from a Maine high school, seek our assistance. We're only able to give it to a small number, but we're trying hard to raise the money to expand that number. I repeat my goal, there should not be in Maine one child, not one, no matter their background, not one child that is denied the opportunity to get a college education and a college degree purely for financial reasons.
You're listening to News Talk, WLOB, 1310 AM, Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O. My final question to Senator George Mitchell. Senator, I am, as I mentioned earlier, elected to the Yarmouth Town Council. I'm also running for the first time for state senate, and I don't want to ask, put you on the spot relative to my specific race, but do you have any final words of advice for somebody who's interested in getting more involved with government, state government, county government, local government, I look at yourself, and as you talked earlier, your work with Senator Edmund Muskie, is you both, if we had a Mount Rushmore here in Maine, maybe that's something I'll work on in the future. I think you both would be on there for your public service. But any final words of wisdom for people who want to participate in the process and they don't want to be discouraged by the climate? So any words of wisdom that you can give would be great.
I speak at a lot of graduations, and I tell the students, and I say to everyone today, most people want success in life, which is customarily defined as status, wealth, a good and productive job. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's human nature. That's appropriate. That exists in all societies. But I guarantee you, the more you achieve status and wealth, the more you realize there must be something more than this to life. And the real satisfaction comes in doing something in a cause that is larger than your own self-interest. And nothing beats helping others, and nothing beats helping youngsters who need help, but who have great, great talent and great, great aspirations. And so I would say you can't do anything better than getting into public office at any level and dedicating yourself to making a better society for those who follow us. We're very fortunate to be Americans. Despite our country's many imperfections, it is the most open, the most just, the most free society in all of human history, and it's based upon the principle that everybody should have a chance.
Senator, it was an honor meeting you 2 weeks ago at the Maine Sports Hall of Fame when you were inducted, and it's also been an honor having you on the radio show. Senator George Mitchell, thank you so much for your service to the state, and thank you for your generosity of time with us this morning, and I wish you and all the work you're doing at the Mitchell Institute all of the best of health and success in the future.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, Senator Mitchell. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB. We'll be back.